If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
How are legends made? How do some stories stick and grow while others fade? Does every myth contain a kernel of truth, or do we invent them from nothing? And what purpose do they serve? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I used to love hiking and camping. My dad and I did quite a bit of it when I was very young. Recently, I suggested to my husband that we take a family camping trip, and he, who also used to love such adventures, replied, "Oh, great! Another thing we have to organize." Fair point. For all our money woes growing up, my dad had very few concrete responsibilities. And so, planning a hiking trip, soup to nuts, wasn't like another thing he had to do, it was the thing he wanted to do. Anyway, these days, truth be told, I prefer to have amenities such as a bed and indoor plumbing. But I do still marvel at the majesty of our grand mountain ranges and often wonder what has gone on inside them, as it were, over the few millennia that humans have been here. I think the Southern Appalachians are among the prettiest places I have ever seen. Those rolling hills and deep green and purple valleys and pastoral vistas of rainbow skies are as breathtaking as any place I know. And they are all the more attractive for their legacy of folk medicine, homesteading, and their aura of mystique as they are for their natural beauty. Did you know the Appalachian Mountain Range is the oldest mountain range in North America? It stretches about 2,050 miles through the eastern and southern United States and Canada from Alabama to Newfoundland and includes the Blue Ridge Mountains, the Great Smoky Mountains, and the White Mountains. The Appalachians were formed about 480 million years ago during what is known as the Ordovician period, don't DM me about that, in the second part of the Paleozoic era. The range is believed to have been part of the central Pangean Mountains before erosion and continental drift broke the massive geological formation apart and created what we now know as the Scottish Highlands, the Appalachians, and the Atlas Mountains in North Africa, among other places. At least three separate mountain ranges on three separate continents with multiple oceans and seas between them. Crazy. It's no wonder the Appalachians have so much strange folklore connected to them. Imagine that the Firth of Clyde, the highest point in Morocco, and Springer Mountain, Georgia, at the foot of the Appalachian Trail, all held hands once upon a time. Imagine the vast ecology of those places and the people who have come to call them home. Imagine all the flora, fauna, environmental changes, snows, sunsets, and lives those mountains have known before they ever became home to the communities that reside among them today. We call Native Americans First Nation people to acknowledge their early existence in these lands and to validate their claim as the true ancestors of this continent. But the Appalachian Mountains have known many firsts before even the Iroquois or Algonquins set foot there. In other words, stranger, we don't know from old the way the mountains do. The Cherokee Nation's predecessors, the Iroquois people of the Great Lakes Nation, have occupied the southern Appalachian Mountains from western North Carolina to parts of South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, and eastern Tennessee since around 8,000 BC. By 1000 AD, these First Nation people were living a woodland lifestyle and practicing many of the cultural and religious traditions that the Cherokee are still known for today. Cherokee history website themoonlitroad.com describes early Cherokee life. Quote, ancestral Cherokees lived in communal villages along mountain valleys, lowlands, and riverbanks, each ruled by clans and a supreme chief. They were a matrilineal culture, meaning mothers were heads of household, and ancestral lines were traced through them. Additionally, they were a largely agrarian people who observed sacred religious practices. Indeed, some territories were built around huge earthen platform mounds believed to have significant spiritual meaning. End quote. On Cherokee land in what is now Fort Mountain State Park in Chatsworth, Georgia, in the Chattahoochee Forest, there are the remains of an impressive, winding, 855-foot-long rock wall. Nobody really knows who built the wall or why they built it. The zigzagging formation, called the Rock Fort, is made up of stones from the mountain's summit. It would have taken a lot of time to move all those rocks so far down to make such a big, old, windy wall. Many assumed, historically, that Native Americans, specifically the Cherokee, built the wall in the 6th century. But the Cherokee themselves seemed to disavow the wall's construction. Instead, Cherokee legend says that though they have been residing in Appalachia for nearly 4,000 years, when they arrived in the region, there were people already living there. These people the Cherokee stories speak of who lived in the hills of southern Appalachia weren't like the Cherokee people. They were a different, strange kind of people. This quote from Blue Waters Mountain Lodge tells the story of the people the Cherokee called Yunwi Tsunzi, which means moon-eyed people, and who the Cherokee say predated them in Appalachia. Quote, in the long, long ago, before the Cherokee came from their homeland of great snakes and water monsters to the mountains of blue smoke and sparkling streams, so said the old men, there lived in these beautiful hills and glades a race of men who were not Cherokee. These men had white skin, bearded faces, and blue eyes like the sky. And they were here even before the lusty Spaniards who came seeking gold. They possessed all the land from the Little Tennessee River to Kentucky with a line of fortifications from one end of their domain to the other. These white men lived in little houses of logs and mud dug out from the inside, and they never emerged from their rounded dwellings in the daytime because they were blinded by light. They came out only at night in the dark of the moon to hunt, fish, build their mounds and fortifications, and carry on warfare. During the full moon, they were stone blind, and so they were called the moon-eyed people. Once at the full of the moon, said the old men, the Creeks came up from the south and drove the moon-eyed people from their beautiful homeland. From where they came and where they went are equal mysteries, but it is told that they were driven far to the west toward the setting sun and vanished into its light. End quote. Okay, right, got it. A tribe of sun-blind, nocturnal, white, short, bearded people, so very unlike the native people of the area, lived in the foothills of Appalachia long ago. But who were these pale weirdos? How did they get there? Why were they so different from literally everyone else who lived on the North American continent? Well, of course, theories abound. Strangers, I had a horrible night's sleep last night. I was so tired, but I absolutely could not quiet my mind. I might have been okay if I hadn't run out of my Cornbread Hemp's amazing CBD sleep gummies. Instead, I took half a sleeping pill around midnight and I am paying the price for it today. Never again, stranger. From now on, I am making sure I have my CBD sleep gummies from Cornbread Hemp. They are a 100% natural, USDA organic way to ease your mind into a good night's sleep without any grogginess the next day. Cornbread Hemp uses only the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest and most potent CBD. No fillers, no junk, just full-spectrum goodness. All of their products are third-party lab-tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. And if you're looking for a little THC support, Cornbread Hemp has delicious seltzers and THC gummies that will get you exactly where you need to be. Right now, Strange and Unexplained listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE. One theory of the Moon-Eyed People is that these pale folk made landfall with a Welsh prince named Madoc Ab Owain Gwynedd. Prince Madoc was a peaceful man who wished to escape the intertribal violence that plagued his homeland, so he left Wales to explore the world and to find a place elsewhere to pursue a tranquil life. And he did all of this some 300 years before Columbus set out on his bloody, misguided, greedy excursion. Legend has it that when Madoc came to the Appalachian region, before he departed again, he left the Welsh language behind. Similar, I suppose, to how my son will carry on repeating weird words and phrases my dad's grandparents used to say to him when he was young. Eventually, my son will still be saying things like "gimmer dem cuppies" without knowing where it came from or what it even means. I guess Madoc supposedly taught Welsh to First Nations people he encountered along the way, which is really saying something, because if you have heard Welsh, you know you might as well teach some random people you meet to build a TARDIS as teach people who don't even speak a language in the same family as Welsh to speak Welsh. I rode a train through Europe with a Welsh guy once. He shared his snacks with us and proved to be entertaining company, even if I understood little of what he said, save for the strings of insults and jokes he rattled off about, well, anyone from anywhere who was not Welsh. He was decidedly different from the story of Madoc, the peacenik of olden times. Still, it was hard to be too bothered by his vitriol when he was an equal opportunity offender and he was generous with his travel wine. Anyway, supposedly, Madoc went back to Wales singing the praises of the calm and fertile lands he'd discovered in his travels, and later returned to the area with ships full of like-minded, peaceful Welsh settlers. It does make me wonder how widespread the clannish violence of Wales was, though. Like, why did Madoc have to board a boat like he was Moana instead of just hiking to another area of his own continent or something? But hey, maybe the sea called him? I don't know. Anyway, given this story, naturally, many people think that Madoc's Welsh settlers must have been the same people described in Cherokee folklore who lived in mud huts and avoided the light. And I guess I get it. It makes a certain sense. White dudes with beards came over in boats. Had to be them, right? But what about their size? Even today, in a lot of the stories, the Moon-Eyed people are also described as little people. Like some kind of American leprechauns. Fun fact, leprechauns are actually an American invention. Irish folklore mostly has really demonic little gnomes and some tricksy fairies that like to drink cream and steal your children. Anyway, Prince Madoc appeared to be a man of imposing stature, at least according to artistic depictions of him, which obviously could be inaccurate. I once saw a statue of William Wallace in Scotland that looked so much like Mel Gibson they had to put a cage around it to keep people from vandalizing it. My point is, artistic depictions of real people are very subjective. Maybe the guy was really tiny but asked the artist to make him look big? And frankly, pretty much everyone on social media is presenting a false version of what they look like. So who really knows what Madoc actually looked like? I guess he could have been as short as Kevin Hart, and no one looking at the history would have been the wiser. More importantly, though, Madoc, like the Welsh people in general, then and now, seems to have been able to see just fine during the day, in sharp contrast to the mole-like vision the Cherokee described the moon-eyed people as having. Wales might get a fair amount of rainfall and cloudy days, but it isn't like some dark cave nation. Maybe the hobbits and dwarves of Tolkien's work were based on the Welsh, but spoiler alert, the Welsh aren't actually hobbits or dwarves living underground wearing showy rock jewelry or eating second breakfast and elevensies. And while the Welsh may have a reputation as being somewhat ornery and their language may be unfathomable to many, I have never known them to be described as having great big lemur eyes or to be notably diminutive in size, you know, like as a people. But this rumor of a Welsh presence in Appalachia isn't confined only to Cherokee folktales. A group of settlers moving through the region in 1608 reportedly met the Monacan native people and described them as speaking a language similar to Welsh. Perhaps this was the tribe that Madoc taught Welsh to before he left. Regardless, it is another arrow pointing to a Welsh presence in the area way back when, even if it is hardly conclusive evidence of Madoc and his men erecting walls and living together as a whole village of mole men. Looking for more specific evidence to support the idea that the Welsh were very early settlers of this continent might lead a person to discover that there are certainly descendants of Welsh settlers in the area today. Thanks, 23andMe. And how they got there and with whom is still a matter of some debate. Just because you're Welsh doesn't mean you are descended from an early Welsh explorer king, you know? But aside from this story of the Monacan Welsh speakers, a Reverend Morgan James also had an account of a native band that he claimed spoke Welsh. The Reverend James told a story in which he said he had been captured by Doeg Indians in either Virginia or South Carolina in 1666. He was amazed, he later reported, to discover that this community of natives actually spoke Welsh. He says the Doeg eventually set him free. This was after he supposedly preached the gospel to them for months on end. I assume he spoke Welsh and used the opportunity of a shared language to try to spread his enthusiasm for the Lord. Honestly, if I picked up a dude and he preached at me, it would take me days, not months, to kick him to the curb, in a manner of speaking. Personally, I think they were too tolerant. The thing about this account, though, is that the Reverend James didn't tell a single soul about this incredible experience with the Doeg for something like 20 years. So, yeah, I don't really know why anyone took his account seriously at all. Why? Why are we listening to Reverend James? Sheesh. Okay, but also in the 1660s, a Welsh sailor named Stedman was supposedly shipwrecked near either Alabama or Florida, or Florabama, or Ala Florida, or whatever. Anyway, he also apparently encountered Welsh-speaking natives. So cool! Except he is another procrastinator. His story didn't get published for more than 100 years. How is that a record of fact at that point? Again, I don't know why anyone would consider this story legit. And so, as Oprah probably says at the end of each evening, later, Stedman. Strangers, this episode of Strange and Unexplained is brought to you by Wild Grain. Wild Grain is the first bake from frozen subscription box for artisanal breads, seasonal pastries, and fresh pastas. All of the items bake in 25 minutes or less. In addition to their classic box, they now feature a gluten-free box and a plant-based box. Plus, of course, you can mix and match. Recently, I had Wild Grain's delicious Belgian waffles that, let me tell you, will blow any diner waffles out of the water. Crispy and light and absolutely delicious. Their chocolate chip cookies are to die for. And of course, their sourdough loaf is unbeatable. Honestly, I have loved everything I've gotten from Wild Grain. Whether it's sweet, savory, pastry, bread, or pasta, Wild Grain is the only place you need to get all your carb cravings covered. This fall, treat yourself and your loved ones to warm sourdough breads and seasonal baked goods from Wild Grain. Rumor has it they have apple cider donuts and pumpkin cinnamon biscuits, so get them before these seasonal items sell out. For a limited time, Wildgrain is offering our listeners 30% off the first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/strange to start your subscription. You heard me, free croissants in every box and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/strange. That's wildgrain.com/strange. Or you can use promo code STRANGE at checkout. Don't miss their seasonal products.
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a one-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product Stock Advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Poorly documented anecdotal experiences aside, though, there does seem to be a lot of overlap between the stories of Welsh settlers in the region and the Cherokee stories of the Moon-Eyed people. Was this tribe of blue-eyed, pale dwarves who couldn't see during the day real? Did the Moon-Eyed people exist outside of Cherokee folklore? In 1797, an author named Benjamin Smith Barton wrote a book called New Views of the Origin of the Tribes and Nations of America, in which the first written account of the Moon-Eyed people can be found. Barton shared a story in his book that he heard from a man called Colonel Leonard Marbury, who was an early settler of Georgia and a Revolutionary War officer who acted as intermediary between Native Americans in Georgia and the U.S. government. The story in question was actually an account by John Sevier, the first governor of Tennessee, who lived in North Georgia and visited Fort Mountain, where he supposedly met the Cherokee chief at the time, Oconostota. The chief, he said, told him the fort had been built by the white men across the river. So, to be clear, this was Barton telling a story he heard from Marbury, who was relating something that Sevier heard from Oconostota. What could possibly be off about this fourth-hand telling of something outlandish that happened many, many generations earlier? Nothing. I am sure it is perfectly historically accurate and not at all made up for convenience and to control the social narrative of the time. Anyway. In this written account, Oconostota allegedly shared with Sevier the Cherokee lore of the Moon-Eyed people. His version also said there were folks living deep in the forests of North Carolina and Georgia prior to the arrival of the Cherokee, and that these people were nocturnal due to extreme light sensitivity. He said the Cherokee took advantage of this and attacked the people during a full moon, driving them out of the region. Why they didn't attack in full light of day, who knows? So this squares up with the version of the story we have heard so far. Even if, in one story, it was the Creek and not the Cherokee that ran the Moon-Eyed people out of town. In Barton's book, Sevier also spoke of a Cherokee elder named Pei, who was said to have a piece of an old book from the Welsh tribe, which would serve as some kind of proof of the Welsh's presence in the region from that time. Unfortunately, Sevier supposedly searched for the book, but discovered it had been destroyed in a fire. How convenient. If you need more than Oconostota's word for it, though, there was also a collection of Cherokee stories by author James Mooney called Myths of the Cherokee, which is referred to often as additional evidence of the existence of the Moon-Eyed people. In Mooney's book, he cites historian John Haywood's 1823 The Natural and Aboriginal History of Tennessee, where Haywood mentions, quote, white people who were expatriated in part and in part were driven from Kentucky and probably also from West Tennessee, end quote. Haywood also says, according to Mooney's book, that in the 17th century, the Cherokee encountered a race of white people on the Little Tennessee River. Of course, Europeans were already here by the 17th century, so I'm not sure why this would have been so far-fetched. Mooney quotes two Cherokee people who told him of people who lived north of the Hiawassee River when the Cherokee arrived in the region. They told him these people eventually went west, and one of these sources describes them as, quote, very small people, perfectly white, end quote. Cool, but I'm not sure these accounts exactly corroborate the existence of the Moon-Eyed people or their Welsh connection. If anything, I'm left with more questions than answers. Why drive the Pale Folk out? Did the natives just not like them? Were they competing for resources? It seems like they could have coexisted somewhat peacefully, considering these elfin-ass people only came out at night, and really, how many resources could they even see to take at night? I guess we'll never know, since they were, as we keep hearing, driven out by one native group or another, so there is no one left to question about it. Were the white tribesmen Okanistada spoke of to Sevier even Welsh at all? Or were they a strange, lost, cryptid race? Or maybe they were just humans whose features and habits looked and seemed different to the native populations common to the area. Okanistada talked about the snaking wall at Fort Mountain being constructed by white men. There is a plaque on the wall that says as much, crediting its construction to Madoc and his band of Merry Welsh followers. I don't know on whose authority that plaque was erected, though, because the verdict on who built the wall and what it was for is far from conclusive. In fact, most professional archaeologists give no credence whatsoever to the notion that the Welsh built it. According to a forum on freepublic.com, quote, there has been no archaeological evidence to back up stories that either this Welsh prince or any others came to explore the New World, said Jared Wood, the manager of the archaeology lab at the University of Georgia, end quote. Wait, what? So the story that so many take as full fact that the Welsh arrived at Mobile Bay in 1170 and traveled the Alabama and Coosa rivers building stone fortifications along the way is actually, according to many scientists, not even true? Basically, the more one researches, the clearer it is that there is no evidence that the Welsh existed in the area that far back. It turns out that lots of people believe there is more credence in the theory that the walls at Fort Mountain and other sites were built by Native Americans between 200 BC and AD 600. They just weren't built by the Cherokee, so that much of Okanistada's fourth-hand account is probably true, anyway. According to the Free Public piece, quote, the stone structures have long been a topic of debate. We're not exactly sure what purposes these enclosures served, said Wood, the UGA archaeologist, but they were likely well-known gathering places for social events, seasonal meetings of friends and kin, trading of goods, astronomical observance, and religious or ceremonial activities may have occurred there, end quote. An article on accessgenealogy.com talks about the sites and this idea of them being built by Welshmen. Quote, the Cherokees, who had moved into the region during the late 1700s, told the settlers that they didn't build these structures. Some Cherokees told the Europeans that they had been built by the Creeks. Supposedly, a temple had once stood inside the fortification, which contained a giant stone snake with ruby eyes. Other Cherokees told of a legend that these mysterious sites had been built by moon eyes, which the Europeans interpreted as being gray-eyed Europeans. The stories were elaborated to the point that most whites assumed that the stone cairns and enclosures were built by Celts, specifically a colony of Welsh led by a Prince Madoc. End quote. So it seems possible, stranger, that white people just assumed, without any real evidence, that other white people built these ancient and enigmatic things. There was no actual proof that any of this stuff about Welsh settlers and albino tribes was true. Instead, those who shared this lore as fact were, in essence, giving white people credit for things created by native people. What? No. I can't believe it. Shocker. a while, there was evidently even a sign donated by the Daughters of the American Revolution on Mobile Bay claiming it as Maddox's landing spot. Someone from the Park Service removed it, though, probably because they knew that that was a bunch of hooey. An article about the moon-eyed people of Appalachia on atlasobscura.com puts it in terms that I think summarize what might have been going on there. The piece says, quote, "Tales of Maddox's Welsh Indians had captured the imagination of jingoistic colonists since Elizabethan times, because their purported existence meant that North America had been claimed for the English long before Columbus arrived in 1492. Thomas Jefferson was a firm believer in them and encouraged Lewis and Clark to search for them during their trek westward. They found none. There were Welsh people living in Appalachia when the moon-eyed people stories began circulating, however. In the 18th century, Welsh settlers came to the region to mine its mineral-rich mountains, leading to tensions with the Cherokee, whose land they were plundering," end quote. Well, you know, if old T. Jeff was into it, we better question the hell out of it.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who pieced together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Folklore historian Peter Stevenson wrote in his 2019 book, The Moon-Eyed People, Folktales from Welsh America, quote, "They called the Welsh moon-eyed people not because they were small, white-skinned, and the men bearded, but because they lived underground and could see well in the dark," end quote. I also encountered one story that says the reason we know the moon-eyed people were underground dwellers is that construction crews unearthed the Little People's Tunnels while building McKee Hall at Western Carolina University in the 1930s. I couldn't find anything else that confirms this discovery, but it is compelling and honestly the most plausible explanation I've seen. Maybe these people were just miners. Mining is known to be a cornerstone of Welsh life since prehistoric times, so that may be another possible moon-eyed slash Welsh overlap. Anyway, mining and its trappings would probably have looked pretty odd to native populations in southern Appalachia, as they were not in the habit of ravaging the earth for minerals or spending lots of, or any time, underground. It makes sense that this story might gain traction, as there were Welsh settlers living in Appalachia around the late 1700s and early 1800s when these tales started to circulate. Those settlers were definitely miners, and they were in conflict with the Cherokee whose land they were mining. Then again, while that interpretation might seem to settle things, it is somewhat at odds with the Cherokee fables and children's stories shared by author Lynn K. Losiya in her book Secrets and Mysteries of the Cherokee Little People. Losiya tells a version of the story where the moon-eyed people are not pale at all, but had similar complexions to the Cherokee. In her version of the story, the little people might be hospitable, or they might be sneaky and treacherous, depending on the situation. And she claims they're particularly vengeful when mocked or betrayed. This version of the moon-eyed people mimics traits that are common to European elves, brownies, or gnomes, and the like, which is an interesting melding of cultures that I can't quite explain. Losiya clearly says in her writing, though, that Cherokee tradition taught the importance of respecting the Yunuit Sunzi and their territory. Quote, "When a hunter finds anything in the woods, such as a knife or a trinket, he must say, 'Little people, I want to take this,'" she wrote, "because it may belong to them. And if he does not ask permission, they will throw stones at him as he goes home," end quote. It's hard to reconcile this version of the moon-eyed people with the sallow miners or the fat, day-blind underground dwellers in other versions of the tale. So, what is true? I have to say, the idea that there were white settlers in the area as far back as all that also begs the question, what about disease? We know that European settlers inadvertently and advertently killed many natives by exposing them to diseases to which they had no immunity. But if these Welsh white settlers were here way back when, would that have been the case for the natives who encountered Columbus and other colonial settlers? Might they not have developed immunity? Or maybe the white men just sort of came with the mountain when it separated itself from the Pangaea version of the Scottish Highlands. Sure, why not? I mean, I joke, but really, it is not much less likely than a lot of the other theories swirling around out there. Finding the truth about the Moon-Eyed people in the stone walls of southern Appalachia, a truth grounded in history, science, and fact, proves to be really difficult. And of course it is, because objectivity is hard to find in stories that bleed reality into folklore, and where so much time has passed. These aren't chapters in history books, and the sources should be considered. For example, the accounts that Sevier shared should obviously be questioned, and not only because the accounts were so far removed from the source, but because Sevier went on to be instrumental in writing the treaties that would lead to the Cherokee removal, or, as we know it, the Trail of Tears. As Tennessee governor, Sevier fought against the Cherokee as more white settlers pushed deeper into Native territory. It is also pretty unlikely that he ever even met Oconostoda, who died in 1783, let alone had the conversations with the Cherokee chief that Barker wrote about in his book supporting the narrative that there were original white settlers in southern lands that had been cruelly driven out by Indians. But, stranger, before you dismiss the stories of the Yunwitsunzi out of hand, there is yet another twist in the story. In 1841, the farmer Felix Ashley was prepping his field for planting when he discovered a relic. Ashley dug up a 3 to 4 foot tall statue that depicted two conjoined figures with round heads. Prior to becoming Ashley's farm, during the Indian removal in 1838, the land was the site of Fort Butler, a collection area along the Trail of Tears, where more than 3,000 Cherokee passed through on their forced march west. Ashley later purchased the site for farmland. The statue, which now resides in the basement of the Cherokee County Historical Museum, is universally thought of as a depiction of the Moon-Eyed people. Michael E. Gouge, in his 2023 article in Blue Ridge Motorcycling magazine, describes his impression of the statue like this, quote, "Staring into the flat faces and round eyes of the statue, which stands about 4 feet tall and weighs nearly 400 pounds, one cannot escape the similarities to modern pop culture representation of aliens. The conjoined twins of the statue feature two figures of different heights," end quote. So, there it is, stranger. We have finally arrived at the other theory about the Moon-Eyed people. Of course we have, that they are aliens. The resemblance of the figures in the carving to the typical gray alien trope we are all familiar with nowadays, or to the ethereal white humanoid aliens of movies like Cocoon or Close Encounters, is uncanny. But aside from the obvious physical similarities, I can't find anything else that links the Moon-Eyed people to an alien species. My golden doodle sometimes looks a lot like Falcor, but that doesn't mean she's actually a flying dog dragon, you know?
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Do Gouge writes in his article about a conversation with local historian and retired professor at Tri-County Community College, Billy Ray Palmer, the region's foremost expert on the myths, legends, and history, who recounts the Moon-Eyed People myth for Gouge and who added that, quote, the Moon-Eyed People were on the east bank of the Valley River across from the Cherokee. According to the myths, the Moon-Eyed People were afraid to cross the river because of the Big Red Leech, end quote. I'm sorry, Big Red what? What in the four humors? Palmer continued by explaining that, quote, the Cherokee would test a young warrior's bravery by making him cross the river where the Big Red Leech lurked as a rite of passage. What was the Big Red Leech? In my opinion, it was a big catfish. It would have been red because of all the iron ore down there, he said, end quote. Oh, okay, phew. Palmer talked more about the statue found by the farmer, saying, quote, we have had several archaeologists and anthropologists look at it. They concur it's authentic. It's pecked out of soapstone and talc. It would have been whiter than it is now because of the soapstone and talc, but where it was found, there is a lot of iron ore in the river, probably what turned the catfish red, and it discolored the statue somewhat, end quote. The choice of soapstone could have been deliberate to create an image that was very white, the way the Moon-Eyed People were said to be so pale and white, the way aliens are said to be so pale and white, the way people from Wales are said to be so pale and white. Sorry, people of Wales, I swear I'm not picking on you. I don't know, though, it feels like a bit of a stretch. White soapstone equals pale, which equals white native tribe, which equals aliens? Boy, people really do just want to believe wacky stuff. We just love it. We love to make utterly implausible connections feel plausible. We love to have evidence that outlandish things are possible. That just because something is strange and unexplained, it doesn't mean it isn't happening. I think it makes us feel like if these things could be true, then anything is possible. Like getting out of debt or not still being tired after a full night's sleep. I think it makes us feel like God might actually exist, and not a mean old women have no rights, gay as a choice God, but like a wise, dreamy God who sleeps in the stones or lives in the riverbed or something. In the end, I don't know what the link is between the legend of Welsh explorers in the Appalachian Mountains and a lost race of small, nocturnal, bearded white folk. I don't know if Moon-Eyed People existed or if there was an alien race that was driven out by the Creek or the Cherokee. I do think those legends might lend themselves too easily to some calcified racist ideals. But I also think my mistake here might be trying to find out the truth about something that is essentially enigmatic. These stories of Moon-Eyed People and conflicting stories of the ancestors of the Southern Appalachian region are part of a whole lexicon of such inexplicable secrets hidden throughout those mountains. It is impossible to know the truth of any of the myths and tales that circulate there. One thing I do know for certain is that Appalachia is ancient and beautiful and full of complicated history, pain, magic, mystery, and eerie wonder. Trying to peel back the layers of that mystery is to dispel the innate sense of wonder that accompanies it. Why would we want to destroy any aspect of the completely unique folkloric ecosystem of a place that, despite having been plundered for its resources, still won't submit to being plundered for fact? Appalachia won't be tamed by a human obsession for control and accuracy, or allow itself to be claimed by any group trying to own it. Appalachia owns itself. Humans are supporting characters in its story. It has outlasted the men in its stories, and it will likely be here long after we are all gone. Appalachia will continue to keep its secrets as it sees fit to do, hiding them away like old gods in peaks, hollows, fog, and deep, quiet pine forests.
Now,
Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we're doing our first ever Ask Me Anything episode. Join us for some listener questions. This episode was written by Eve Kerrigan and me, Daisy Egan, with research by Keely Hise. Sound engineering by Jeff Devine. Music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. For more amazing content, join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab, where for just $5 a month, you get all the Grab Bag exclusive shows, and for $8, you get those, plus Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries and Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab, or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.